Late Night City with Roy Basner. And now, my story. Real people, real stories.
Good morning, Amanda.
Good morning, Roy.
Right, Amanda, best-selling author, number of books out, coming to St. Helens Library. Lots going on in your life at the moment, and you've actually been on this show before, haven't you?
I have, speaking to the lovely Mr. Price.
Right.
Who I believe is sunning himself at the moment, is that right?
Well, I don't know. He's either doing that or he's sorting his allotment out. So one way or the other, he's doing something that is not on the radio. When you came on last time, you were talking about something, and this time you're talking about another book that you've got out. And the interesting thing about this book is that you've got life, you know, aspects of your life that are relative to this book as well, haven't you?
Yeah, definitely. What I wanted to do was write a book that I thought would relate to a lot of people at the moment who are caring for someone. It's really, really common for carers, you know, in the UK to be women, but it's also men that care for people as well. But people in that sandwich situation where they're looking after maybe an elderly relative or a parent who is sick or has Alzheimer's, but also looking after their kids and their grandchildren. And I just thought what it's like, you know, to be in that situation where there is no time for you. And I watched my own mum do that, Roy. You know, she looked after my lovely nan just before she passed away for a couple of years. And it's just exhausting. And I think the main thing that struck me was, you know, if you're looking after babies or children, you kind of know it's going to get easier. You know, they're going to go to nursery. They are going to learn to be potty trained. But if you're looking after someone who's old or infirmed, it's not really going to get better. And it's absolutely exhausting, wearying.
Yeah. No, it is. It's one of those things that I've never been in a situation where I've had to do it, and I hope that, as awful as that might sound, I hope that I don't have to, because I genuinely believe that people who are carers have to be a special breed of person. It's not for everybody. You've got to have incredible patience. Mm. You've got to have tremendous empathy. I'm not sure if I possess those qualities.
Do you know what? That's really funny you said that, Roy, because everyone I spoke to in an interview when I was writing the book said to me, oh, you know, I feel so guilty. I think about the days I was a bit tired or a bit short with my mum or my dad, or I think about the days where I didn't hold their hand long enough, or I was tired, I was a bit snappy. And it's just amazing to hear people who have worked tirelessly and selflessly day in and day out. They don't remember the hundreds of days they did a great job. They remember those 20 minutes where they maybe had a shout. It's funny, isn't it? That human nature thing, that guilt that goes with it.
Yeah, incredible. Well, let's go back a little bit, because obviously I know you've sponsored Pete before, but my first time with you, Amanda. Tell me a little bit about your life and how you actually became an author.
Well, I'm dead ordinary, you know. I'm just a wife and a mum. My husband was a soldier, and we've got two lovely boys, and we've moved around a lot. Just very, very ordinary, and I come from an ordinary family. My dad worked in Fords and Dagenham's, building cars. My mum was a hairdresser. My granddad worked in the docks, and we lived in the East End of London for most of our life. And I always wanted to write stories, but to be honest, Roy, I didn't come from a house where we had lots of books. You know, we had a Little Woods catalogue and a copy of the Yellow Pages. That was it, you know. It wasn't very bookish. And I'd certainly never known anyone that had written a book. I didn't really know anyone that read many books. But I always loved reading. And I remember when I was about 14 reading Colleen McCulloch's The Thorn Birds. It was like a big book at the time. I'm nearly 50, so we're going back a bit. But I just remember thinking, my goodness, if you can make someone feel that way, you know, give them a bit of escape. And I went to a library. My mum took me to a library, and I remember this lady very clearly saying to me, you know, giving me my little Dewey Decimal card system and saying, you can take as many books home. You can take 6 or 7 books home, and then when you've read them, you can bring them back. I just remember feeling, goodness me, she's trusting me with this incredible, you know, this gift. And books have proved to be such an important part of my life. They've made me feel secure. They've made me feel safe. They've taken me on adventures. They've reassured me. They've uplifted me. They've made me think. And I always wondered if I had in me to write a story. And I think if you can, you often do, don't you? You sort of think you might be able to. Mm. But it wasn't until I got diagnosed with cancer and I was in my late 30s. And I was, you know, young, fit, healthy mum, just jogging along, didn't have any symptoms. And I got struck down with bowel cancer, which was really shocking. And I always say, I know it sounds odd, Roy, but it was like the best and the worst thing that ever happened to me. It was the worst thing for obvious reasons. You know, we've all been touched by cancer and it's horrible. But the best thing, because it made me realize this is my one time round the block. And I thought, what do I really want to do? And I remember my husband came home from an R&R. He was away on tour at the time. And I said, I've decided I'm going to give up my job and I'm going to write books. looks, and I saw his face sort of drop, and he went, well, if that's what you want to do, you know, and with a completely skin, because obviously we used to two wages coming in, and you just get used to every penny, don't you, you know, and so my wages just stopped dead, and that was it. So we maxed out 2 credit cards, and at first it was a bit of an adventure, you know, we didn't have any money, and things were difficult, and it was like quite, oh, this is exciting. Well, after a couple of months, that soon wore thin, you know, not being able to eat meat and buy the kids trainers and all that. It was horrible, really. And I wrote my first book, and it was called Poppy Day, about a young girl whose husband gets taken hostage in Afghanistan and what she does to try and bring him home.
Right.
And that book I sent everywhere. I sent to agents, I sent to publishers. No one wanted to look at it. They just, you know, no one was interested. And then we had the idea to self-publish it. And by sheer coincidence, just as we were about to launch the book, we were staying at this sort of hostel hotel in London for army personnel and military personnel. And we bumped into a group of lads who had just come back from Afghanistan, and they'd all been seriously injured. They had double and triple amputations. And that moment, that changed our life for him. I said to Simeon, what can we do? Because the only reason he comes back, you know, from tour intact is just luck. Mm. And the reason others don't is just bad luck. And you never have enough money to make a difference, do you? No matter what you want to do, it's always, you know. So we suddenly thought, what about if we get the book published and we, you know, use that money, give it to the Royal British Legion to do some good for people who have come back hurt? And we thought we might sell, I don't know, a couple of hundred copies. Well, that book to date has sold nearly 1 million copies worldwide.
Wow, that's incredible.
And all that money goes to help the RBL, which is just brilliant. But, of course, we were still skint. So it didn't really, you know, even though it was a wonderful thing. And I'm so proud of it because, you know, we love anyone that serves for our country. It's an amazing thing. So the fact that you can just sort of do something to say thanks feels, you know, really good. Mm. And then my second book, I got picked up by a publisher and an agent, which was like a dream come true. That book sold 250,000 copies in the first month.
Wow.
And I haven't looked back, Roy, to be honest. This is my ninth.
So when you were the first book and you were taking it around, do you feel as though perhaps maybe there was a little bit of perhaps maybe intellectual snobbery in that with the publishers thinking, who is this working class person trying
to
be? Yeah.
Definitely. And I didn't understand how it worked. So, I mean, to be honest, the copy we made that we got published, it was a bit scrappy. You know, it wasn't flash and glossy and it wasn't even a good size. It was quite a mini book, really. Mm. And I remember taking it round and I wasn't ashamed of it. I loved it. The fact that I'd finished a book for me was a great achievement. But I think people were sort of saying, you know, oh, you know, who are you with? Who's your agent? I was saying, oh, I haven't got one. And, you know, where are you stocked? Oh, nowhere. You know, it was kind of a bit like that. But I think in some ways it did me a favour because I didn't see all the boulders that should have been in my way. Mm. I didn't understand why I wasn't going to succeed. And let's face it, statistically, you know, everything was against me succeeding. But I don't think I saw any of those boulders or blockages. I didn't understand how you played the game. Mm. So I kind of just went ahead and we were selling it, you know, out the back of the car boot. We were selling it everywhere and anywhere we could. Mm. And it sort of built its own momentum. But it's interesting now, right, because those people who rejected me outright are now coming back and saying, oh, you know, I really like the look of this. And I'm thinking, gosh, I remember that letter you sent me saying, you know,
That must be incredibly satisfying. I know it sounds a little bit, but I mean, it is. It's satisfying, surely.
It is a little bit, yeah.
Yeah. But what about you kind of this journey that has taken you through, you know, heights of emotion and the euphoria of getting the book all sorted out? Do you feel as though there's an element of it was meant to be, or are you just, you know, life is just a sequence of random events?
No, I think it's definitely meant to be. It's been a really strange journey for me because almost every bit of really, really bad news or rubbish news has been sort of followed a couple of months later by a real high, almost like you have to, I don't know, I kind of feel that sometimes you have to go through the really rough bits to get to the good, if that makes sense. Mm. And I think, you know, I was a single mum for years. That was horrible, you know, working hard and just me and my little one, and we lived in grotty bedsits. It was horrible. Mm. And now I've got lovely husband, and I think, do you know what, it's funny, isn't it, because if I didn't know how bad it was to go through that, maybe I wouldn't appreciate what I got now.
Yeah.
And it's like your health, you know, I took my health for granted. I was young, I was fit, I was out there. I never ever thought for a minute that I would be felled by something like cancer. That's what happened to other people. But of course that's what everyone thinks.
Yeah.
And in a way, it's made me look at life, and I value every single day. Every day I laugh. I love the people around me that are kind to me. I appreciate kindness. I appreciate little things. You know, it's not the big stuff in life that makes a difference. It's not winning the lottery or owning a Mercedes, although let's face it, that'd be nice. It's not that. It's having a good cup of coffee. It's having someone who to, you know, turn to when you're feeling a bit low. It's having a roof over your head.
It's one of those things that perhaps maybe I've learned to appreciate myself a little bit more. You know, this random act of kindness. And it was a funny thing. I do like to do me a little bit, but sometimes I think, well, am I doing enough? And then a few weeks back, we took the dog for a walk and we were driving back. And I said, I need to get some petrol from the petrol station. And there was a family there. And the car had basically, the battery had gone flat. Mm-hmm. Now, the people in the garage, they only wanted to borrow some jump leads to get the vehicle going. But they said, no, we'll sell you them. And they only had these really expensive ones. And I felt, I looked and I thought, I've got some here. And I thought, it's not my problem, I'll drive off. And I went to drive off and I stopped and said, no, look, imagine if that was me. And I went over. I went over and I said, look, what's the problem? He told me. He said, well, let's have a go. Let's see if we can get it going. And somebody tried to do it and it didn't work, but I was maybe a bit lucky. And it worked. And you know what? We drove off and they were so happy. They were so delighted. There were kids in the car, man and his wife, and they just drove off. And I thought, it doesn't cost me, it didn't cost me anything apart from a little bit of my time, 10 minutes of my time. And you think, but unfortunately we do live in a world now where people aren't like that. And I think there are more people like that now that really don't care than there have ever been before.
Yeah, it feels like that, doesn't it? Mm. But what I find now, I don't know about you, but I think the more good I put out, the more I get back.
Yep.
You know, and that's absolutely true. I said to someone a little while ago, I find that I'm very smiley anyway because I'm genuinely very happy.
I can tell that by the tone of your voice. Yeah.
It drives people mad. I wake up 5 a.m. smiling and they're like, oh, put a lid on it. You know, they want me to calm down a bit. But if you smile at people in the street, sometimes they look at you and think, well, you know, it's alien to them. They're not used to seeing it.
Yeah.
And it takes them a while to get used to smiling back. But once you do, it's like you make a little connection. And I kind of imagine it during the day. I smile at someone and then they smile at someone else. And it kind of is a little chain smile going on. I hope so.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, like that.
So coming back to the books then, of the nine books you said you had, is there a little bit of Amanda Prowse in all of those books?
No, there's a lot of me in them. I think it'd be hard to write about people and things that I hadn't really experienced or didn't know. I think I'd find that difficult. So all my books kind of, even though some of the stories are, obviously it's all fiction, but they're kind of seeded in things that I've experienced a little bit. So one of my books is about postnatal depression, which I suffered with a little bit, but I could imagine, you know, how bad it would be to have it really badly, which I spoke to Pete about last time I was on. And things like, racism in the 1960s that directly affected my family. That's what they went through. So I wrote a book set in the 1960s called Clover's Child, all about that. So even though it might not be something that's happened to me directly, Roy, it's something that I've, you know, just verbal stories handed down from my family, from my nan and granddad, from my aunts and uncles, you know, things I can kind of know about a bit. Because I think if you don't know about it or it's not true to you, it doesn't sound right when you're reading it.
Right, I see.
You know, it's got to have a bit of authenticity.
I get that. So I take it there's no like 50 Shades in the back of your mind or anything like that.
Tell you what, no. More likely a walk up Marine Parade and a bag of chips at the end if you're lucky, I'm afraid.
So coming back to the new book, and Perfect Daughter. So obviously this very relevant because, I mean, it's constantly in the news about people that have to care for parents, have to care for disabled people and stuff like that. And it really, really is a huge, huge kind of responsibility. I won't use the word burden because obviously the people who are carers never would use that term. But it's almost as if these days they've been cut adrift and it's like, hey, you want to look after somebody? That's your problem. When you think of these people and what they do, how much they probably save the government money in terms of like, well, otherwise these people might have to be hospitalised or they might need, you know, permanent care from somebody who has to be paid for.
Oh, don't get me started, Roy. These carers are so undervalued. They are the backbone of our society. They are doing jobs that no one would want to do at a wage that most people couldn't afford, and they do it for free near enough. And if you worked out any small allowance they do get over the hours they put in, it's pennies. And I don't understand why as a society we don't value people who care for other humans. How can it be that someone can, so you started me now, Roy, so look, I'm on my little soapbox.
Oh, you go on, that's what this program's about.
How can can it be that someone can sit in an office, can put a suit on and earn twice as much as someone who's a nurse, who's a carer, who's driving an ambulance? Yeah. How does it work? I don't, honestly, I swear to God, I don't understand it.
Mm. No.
I don't understand how that's happened.
I have my kind of way of thinking on this as to why it's happened. I think perhaps without going into too much detail, because we'll veer too far off what we're all about. I blame the 1980s for everything. I'll tell you why. Because I believe that it's under a certain prime minister that the greedy people.
Greed.
Really, really flourished in the 1980s.
That's
yuppies,
the word.
And they have given birth to children who don't know anything other than greed.
No,
I believe
you're right.
Now, and I think that that's where the problem is in the world.
Mm-hmm. And also, but it's that. Imagine not having that. I sort of feel that I look at my grandparents' generation and my mum and dad's generation and mine to a degree, and I think, you know, back to when my nan and granddad were younger, we were looked after by everyone in the street. Because there was a community. And it wasn't about how much money you had. No one had a spare bedroom. No one had a bloody car. It wasn't about that. It was about feeding all the kids, babysitting, looking after each other so that we could all do part-time jobs and work. But now if you don't know the person you live in next to, that sense of community is gone.
Yeah.
And as soon as you lose your community, you lose an understanding of people outside your family. Even your family himself might be living away. Once you lose that basic human understanding of each other, you're isolated. And when you're isolated, you look inside and then you get greedy, then you get self-indulgent, self-reflective. You're not looking at what you can give back to a wider community. It's a tragedy.
Yeah. One of the aspects of the book, Perfect Daughter, is that in it, is it the mother that's suffering from Alzheimer's disease?
Yeah.
I mean, even there is, I know obviously caring comes into that, but there is something else that is so much of a problem. There's many things I'd be terrified of contracting when I got older. Alzheimer's disease is such an emotional theft. If you've lived such a wonderful life and to have that, every aspect of it, because I always believe that, you know, I'm like you, I live for today. And that perhaps maybe in the years to come, I might be incapacitated, I might be lying on a bed there. The only thing I've got left at that point is the things that I've done in my life, the happy memories.
Absolutely.
And to have those stolen from you as well would
is
a crime and a
half. It's wicked. It's a wicked disease, Roy. And the thing is, I think, I look at my nan, obviously, and she died a couple of years ago, bless her. But, you know, everyone loves their nan. I love my nan. She was massive influence on my life. She was really clever. You know, she never went to school. She didn't really, you know, she didn't have a fancy job or anything. But she was so clever. She could knit things. She could bake things. She could make birthday cakes. She could make apple pie. She could make me laugh. You know, she'd let me cheat at cards. She was absolutely wonderful. She was a right old East End bird. She was fantastic. But the saddest thing was to see her at the end, because anyone that ever met her only knew her like that, you know, an old lady in elasticated, wasted pants who needed lots of attention. They didn't see her. They didn't know her. And that breaks my heart because she was amazing. She was my amazing nan.
Mm.
You're robbed of all that, aren't
you? Indeed. Well, with the books, you're very, very proud of your career in literature. Has there ever been any approach to you to say, hey, Amanda, we want to take one of your books and we want to turn it into a movie?
Yeah, there is, actually. It feels like, when I talk about it, it's like I'm talking about someone else, because it's so, I can't describe it, Roy. It's so far out of my sort of, my life. I find it absolutely incredible. But at the moment, they're talking about two of my books being made into films with big American companies. And I just have to, I'm one of those people that, you know what, that sounds amazing. But until it happens, I always think, well, you know, it's easy to say it, isn't it?
Listen, I've counted my chickens too early on too many occasions, I can tell you. Yeah, that'd be tremendous. I think that probably would be the icing on the cake for your career, wouldn't it?
Do you know what would be nice? It'd be nice to finally say to my kids, come on, let's a film we all want to see together, because it'd be one of my books. That'd be nice, because they never want to do anything with their mum.
I'm
18 and 19, I don't blame them.
Yeah, you'd be able to get them cheap tickets as well, then.
I'd hope so. Free popcorn, maybe, Roy. Hey, we could negotiate it.
As obviously, we just mentioned the book there, but you are doing a tour as well, and you're going to be coming to St. Helens Library.
I am,
the 16th of July. Not that 16th, long off now.
No, next week. Can't wait. Really looking forward to it.
What kind of things will happen when you come to the library?
Well, basically, I do a talk, and it's more or less, it's more or less what I've said this evening, but it's sort of a motivational talk about my journey to getting published, my story, overcoming, you know, certain obstacles in your life. Maybe you've got something you really, really think, God, I wish I'd always done that. And it's about how you look, you know, maybe you've got more years behind you than ahead, but you know what? It's never too late to let yourself start living and to put things in place, to give yourself a bit of time. And that little element of selfishness that sometimes can make the difference in a really tough world. If you take half an hour for yourself just to have a coffee, have a walk, whatever it is, but making time for yourself, achieving your goals, overcoming obstacles and staying positive.
I think that's an incredible way to finish our interview. So, listen, Amanda, it's been an absolute pleasure speaking to you.
Do you know what? I've loved it. Good old natter that, Roy.
Oh,
lovely.
Good, good. Yeah, I should have been a woman, shouldn't I? I've just angered loads of feminists there now. So there's my next debate coming up in the next half hour of the show anyway. The book's called Perfect Daughter. If you want to go meet Amanda in person, St. Helens Library on the 16th of July. Do we know what time that is, by the way? I'm not going to tell anybody.
It's in the evening, but if you go to the St. Helens Library website, I think that's the best thing, and all the details will be on there, or call the library or nip in and they've got more information. But it'd be lovely to see everyone. It really would.
Tremendous. Amanda, thanks for speaking to us on City Talk.
Oh, I'd loved it. Thanks, Roy.
Biggest After Hours talk show. This is Late Night City with Roy Basner on City Talk 105.9.